I changed the title a little bit to squeeze things, but it makes little sense, so I will take it from there. Kinetoplastid flagellates, and in the next slide, actually, I put five topics in the order of interest here. So as I know, the talks get sometimes longer, so if we miss this one, nothing happens pretty much, okay? But I thought, let's say, extreme complexity, unexplainable complexity of the mitochondrion can be a nice thing to start with. So I always, at least for this audience, I would just put five slides how protists are important. This is the a little bit outdated tree of eukaryotic life with the superdomains. And as a matter of fact, most of these branches are protists. As I showed, these are only the three slides that overlap with my previous talk. They are enormous in the diversity of shapes. This one, Gregorine. Gregorine. So it's alveolate. They are enormous in size of their genome. Okay, so encephalitozoon is the smallest eukaryotic genome so far, and then you have these. This is human, just to put it into perspective, and then are these giant genomes of dinoflagellates or amoeba. So what these guys are encoding there, we still don't know very much, but it's mostly junk. Well, I will not. You did not hear the word. I don't want to start the discussion yet on this. They have enormous variety of organelles. Always derived from the mitochondrion, but changed to the conditions that they live in. And here is just to show how many species out there. So the catalog species, if you have the catalog species, out of those 2 million catalog species of eukaryotes, protists will have a small slice. But if you take environmental sequences into account, then they represent 70-75% of all species. And just to the TARA project, from all the ribosomal RNA sequences, only about 2% fit this described species. And the estimated number now of protists is 1 million without going into details. So today I will be talking just of one relatively small group, which is part of excavates. And as you break it down, you are not taxonomists, so never mind, but just to the kinetoplastids and this group of euglenids. This is an emblematic picture of trypanosomes in blood. So of course, those are pathogenic organisms. I think I have one more or two more slides. The most best known representatives are Trypanosoma brucei, causing sleeping sickness, Crouse eye, Chagas disease, Leishmania, Leishmaniasis. These afflict still tens of millions of people all over the world. There are some quick numbers here. With pretty much localization of these diseases. So you see Leishmaniasis is still widespread. Chagas disease actually became a problem in Spain now. As far as I know, it's transmitted by transfusion. So they are still, of medical relevance. But I will be talking about them more from the perspective of cellular biology and evolutionary biology today. So trypanosomes have a really long list of unusual features, and this is just the best known one. The list can and actually grew much, much longer, but I will today talk only about the features that are associated with the mitochondria. So this is mitochondrial DNA, just isolated one network, and I will show you how that operates. Trypanosomes can change their surface, They have polycystronic transcription. They just have things that do not fit with the picture of a typical eukaryotic cell. And this is what I would like to say. So they were considered kind of outliers, a bizarre group. I don't believe that, actually. I believe that most protist groups will be outliers with very major departures from the textbook eukaryote. We just don't know much about them. Trypanosomes are intensely studied for 100 years. They are amenable to all methods of molecular genetics now. So So these unique processes have been observed there, but I'm sure as long as you go deep into molecular biology of some protist lineage, you will find similar oddities. So to explain to you more about the processing of mitochondrial RNAs and the vagaries of it, I have to take you a little bit, just two slides, I think, through the mitochondrial DNA of trypanosomes, called kinetoplast DNA. Actually, the first extra nuclear DNA ever observed. And so the genome is actually extremely complex, and this is the simple version of it. The other kinetoplasts have it much more complex. It's composed of about 5,000 circular molecules that are interconnected with each other in a perfectly organized manner. So in the cell, it looks like a disk that is attached to the basal body of the flagellum. And it's two networks. It's a network of maxicircles. There are about 20 of them. And those are actually homologs to the typical mitochondrial DNA. So they encode subunits of respiratory complexes, just relatively normal stuff. But then there is 5,000 small circular molecules, and nobody had a clue what they are doing. They were observed in electron microscopy pictures 30 years before their existence was explained on the basis of molecular biology.
Question.
Uh-huh.
So is the structure of the mitochondria themselves reticular? Or is it a bunch of individual sort of bacteria?
Okay, so they have a single reticulated mitochondrion, and the size of it actually reflects the stage in which they are in within the life cycle. So the mitochondrion can be downregulated, upregulated. It's pretty well known. And here is the remarkable, right? Yes. No. That's right, yeah. It's and they are really beautifully catenated with three members each. And this is how it works. A group of labs, especially Paul Englund's lab in Baltimore, but also Dan Ray and so on, found this out. So you have this network here, and there are two antipodal sites, a group of proteins on the periphery of it. And during replication, this network is spinning, slowly and steadily spinning, between these two antipodal sites. And these mini circles are decatenated from it. Then they migrate into what is called the kinetoflagellar zone. They replicate there. And then the daughter molecules go into one of these antipodal sites and are recatenated back. Because what you have to consider, the mini circles, I say that they are there, but not why, but because I will explain it in a moment. But you have to imagine that the cell has to replicate 5,000 mutually interconnected molecules, always once, and get them into the daughter cells. And so there is about 100 proteins known that participate in it, but there will be probably 150. That's how the whole thing goes. I could give a talk about it, but the system actually keeps small nicks in those replicated molecules, so distinguishes what was replicated and what was not. And when you have, out of these 5,000, you have 10,000 mini circles, and all are interconnected, then it splits into two networks. And so the central dogma of molecular biology is shown here. But at some point in 1993 in Amsterdam, they found a weird thing, which was considered at that time.
Mm-hmm. I have a question about previous slide. You said correctly that each of them is pierced by three arteries. Each of these mini circles is pierced by three arteries.
Everyone by three.
But then, how? What is the machinery that counts to three and
no? There are several topoisomerases. There are at this point seven mitochondrial DNA polymerases, different ones.
Yeah.
Okay. There is a system. There must be a system that exactly counts with how many. It's not known yet.
Can I say, George, it's not known. It's almost certain that it's mechanical. That it's a sort of physical structure that does this, and where the size of the molecules is responsible for it. So the way that that made it, you can think of it like chainmail.
Right. Chainmail, yes.
The ring is catenated in the same way, and it's probably a matter of what the size of these molecules is and where they are. Because one thing Joyce didn't mention is all of these mini circles are very close in size.
They are all the same size based on a species. So if they are in some, well, they can be one kb or they can be 10 kb. They also can be maybe non-catenated. What I did not say, but because I did not dwell on it, they are not supercoiled. So these are circular DNA molecules that are permanently non-supercoiled because they are catenated. So in kinetoplastics, you either have the molecules are catenated and relaxed, or non-catenated and supercoiled. So you have kinetoplastids that have thousands of minicircles in their mitochondrion. And they are supercoiled but non-catenated. So you have either one or two, or the other.
It's very interesting because in physics, such a chain mail is called a limbic gel. And most protocols to prepare limbic gels, which are gels of concatenated circles, lead to structures which have some average number of piercing for every circle, but not mechanically identical. Uh-huh.
Exactly three? I mean, it's certainly not a broad range. But
I think exactly three, yes. That has been shown.
And presumably the physical organization, that another point, I think the space between these purple disks that you've drawn here is, I think, defined.
There is really a lot known, but there are still big questions. So, for example, if you have 5,000 catenated circles, each with three neighbors, but then you have 10,000 in the duplicated network, then they are catenated with six neighbors, so it's a total mess, and then it separates still. And that is totally unknown, and maybe we have one first protein that actually is part of the separation, but I am not going to talk about that.
Is there any reason? So you mentioned there's these types of gels and concatenated circles. I mean,
the reason will come.
Why?
Yes, it's coming. The reason is coming.
I know this is really what you want to be talking about. So in the end, that there's no DNA anymore in the purple part, and the replicated DNAs are now in the green.
So here you have a number of proteins that simply. Topoisomerases again that reattach the circles back into the network. Okay, but the beauty is, and it was measured, that it's really spinning, and they are taking from the periphery. So you can see that the first mini circles that were taken out and replicated come from the periphery, and then the system kind of proves reads and goes into the middle of the disk. But keeps track by leaving a tiny nick in every replicated mini circle. So if you label the nicks, you can actually see how they are spreading throughout the network. And so this is the finding that is now 20 years old, but it's still pretty kind of crazy. So in this mitochondrial DNA of kinetoplastids or trypanosomes and so on. So here you have ATPase6, but you would never recognize it. It has termination codons. It has no sequence similarity with a typical ATPase6. But we now know it is ATPase6. What happens is the following. So this is the pre-edited messenger RNA into which nucleotides will be inserted. And the nucleotides are always uridines for us, some reason. The inserted uridines are in red small letters, but then there are uridines in blue letters that are encoded in the, by the DNA but will be removed through the process. And then there are black uridines that are encoded by the DNA and will not be removed and will stay as good nucleotides. The process moves on from the 3 prime to the 5 prime end for good reasons. We know why. I can tell that later on. And you see, it totally changes the transcript. So you would think, okay, the dogma almost has been changed because you have DNA, RNA, then massively changed RNA, and only that RNA is translatable. So it was at the time considered, well, these are introns and so on, but they are not. And so now, when you translate this, first of all, even the start codon is generated by the process, and you have hundreds of uridines, over 600 of uridines that have been inserted into hundreds of positions, and dozens of uridines, the blue stars, that have been removed. And now when you translate this into the amino acids, you have perfectly normal ATPase subunit 6. But trypanosomes arrive to it in a crazy way. In our mitochondrion, we also have ATPase6. Every eukaryote, pretty much in its good mitochondrion, has ATPase6. But it's DNA, RNA, protein. Here it's DNA, RNA, massive restructuring, and then translation. And in all these steps, it gets increasingly complicated. I just showed you the DNA part, which is the most complicated organelle DNA so far. But it does not stop there at all. Where does the information come from? So that are those minicircles, okay? The thousands of minicircles. They encode what we call guide RNAs, small molecules, and this is how it works. So the information from the guide RNAs is transmitted to the pre-edited messenger RNA. And just not to, in order not to go into details, because we have limited time, the guide RNA will hybridize in a small piece with the pre-edited messenger RNA. Then it has so-called information region, and that will be used by the protein machineries to insert or delete uridines in a proper way. Then the guide RNA is removed and another one will come in its place. And I will show that in a moment. The interesting thing is that not all messenger RNAs are edited. Some are, some not. You take another species and that will have a different subset edited and different not. But there is a pattern and we think we know how that came into being. And this is how it goes very quickly. So you have always piece that is not edited in the 3 prime end, to which the first guide RNA will anneal. Then it will decode a piece of the messenger and detach, and another guide RNA will come in, and so on, until the whole molecule is edited. This is another rendition of it. So you have a guide RNA here. It does its job, detaches. Only the second guide RNA can attach to the already edited part. So it's a beautiful machinery that simply will take care of the molecule. Of course, it cannot make a single mistake because otherwise you have a non-translatable molecule. Now with deep sequencing, we know that only very few molecules make it to properly edited ones, maybe 1 to 2%. Most molecules are partially edited, editing stalls, stutters, falls off. There are mis-editing by misguiding. The system makes mistakes, but it still works. because you, in the end, you need ATPase6 to survive. You die otherwise. So here are, in red, these are subunits of respiratory complexes, typical respiratory complex, okay. There are some departures, but nothing extraterrestrial. But there are these edited molecules. So in each of these, you have at least one edited mitochondrial encoded one. And so if there is a problem with editing, the cell dies. David?
So the example that you showed, right, CA6, showed six guide RNAs that provide the path from the pre-edited version to the mature version.
That's right.
There are, what, five edited
You have somewhere around 13 edited transcripts.
And each of them has on the order of, let's say,
eight, 10. Yeah.
That's 100 guides.
That's right.
And there are 5,000 guides there. Is that path of six that you show a path, or is it the path?
Okay. It's most likely a path because there are alternatives. So every guide RNA has a kind of guide RNA that overlaps with it. And if cell loses that minicircle with that particular guide RNA, backup guide RNA from another minicircle can take over. It will make even more mistakes, but eventually it will produce a functional, it will bridge it. So there is thousands of guide RNAs there, but only about 100 are needed at a certain point.
So is it known whether, for example, there are guide RNAs that match and correct common mistakes that you observe?
Yeah, there are cell papers that are titled misguiding, misediting by misguiding, and so on. So you have some evidence for that. The main idea is that all this is producing alternatively edited molecules, okay? That you would not keep this complex machinery unless you just, if you could make it with 100 guide RNAs. And this is permanently debated, and I may allude to it in a moment. Zé?
I'm showing the gun. If you just describe the kinetic plot of machinery of one organism, one specific instance in the tree of life, or of the whole group? Because you mentioned some...
So there is a big diversity in it, although there is still a common umbrella. RNA editing is present in all kinetoplastids. It is always uridine insertion and deletion. I'm not talking about transfer, mitochondrial transfer RNAs editing, which is different kind of editing. Okay, but we could be here for hours. So editing apparently will be performed by a number of enzymatic steps. They, in principle, have to be accurate because they, in the end, have to make at least few fully functional translatable messengers, and I said the rest. This is the editosome. I would not stop there. It's a big complex of proteins. Pretty much all of these proteins are, actually all are known. All have been mutated, and it was shown, the work with trypanosome is beautiful. You can really do RNAi very quickly. You mutate this one, a domain there, and you can see that, for example, insertions stop and deletions are still ongoing and so on. You can really dissect the whole thing. And so all was good, okay? And big labs, especially in the US, did a nice work. It was kind of thought, this is done. People think, okay, editing is kind of done. But no, not really. And again, I'm rushing through it. This is the components of the editosome, the machinery that puts the guide RNAs together with the pre-edited messenger RNAs, and all the activities that are needed to bring the uridines or take them out are there. But then it was shown that there were also some other proteins in 10 years ago, five, that were also needed for editing, but not part of this complex. And this group actually increased now, so we have about 50 50 of these and still counting. And we and others are working on other complexes. So there is a host of complexes, and editosome is just one of them. And these complexes are extremely dynamic in their structure. So once a group purifies them and defines them, it's always a snapshot. So another group, so we have never-ending discussions, which is the genuine one, which is the core, and so on, which are peripheral. So there is a lot of protein complexes that do the job. And I will summarize, and this is style of how you study the interactions, and we have done yeast to hybrids on all of this, and so we are progressing, okay? Sometimes crystal structures have been solved. This one was really fun. It's so-called matchmaker. It's a new fold, and it's a matchmaker. So you have pre-edited messenger RNAs, and you have guide RNAs. Imagine those hundreds of guide RNAs swimming around, partially edited messengers. So this protein complex actually puts the pre-edited and the proper guide RNAs together. So if you mix all the guide RNA or some guide RNAs with pre-edited messengers in the tube, you will have very little hybridization between them. If you add this protein complex, it will go 100 times higher. It has crazy things. It has I have to go move on. And this is how the whole thing works. Maybe. Very simplified still. So here you have an editosome. I did not tell you that the editosomes, there is one type of editosome that inserts uridines and then another one that deletes them. And that there is a third editosome that takes care of only one transcript for good reasons, which I cannot describe because of time. So this is an insertion editosome. This one inserts. Again, this one will insert, this one will delete, and so it goes. It has to go extremely fast, otherwise the cell would go nowhere, okay? But in the end, again, you have the edited molecules. And now, so a little bit for this audience, discussion, why? Why all this? And there were, since the discovery, bright minds were debating about the evolutionary advantage or why did this evolve? And here you have a bunch of reasons that have been discussed widely in the literature, but I can tell you one thing, none of them, in my view, is correct. It just happened, okay? It's just irremediable complexity, we call it, and I think we showed that. This is, you can also have a look at it from this perspective. I mean, you can cut hair by scissors, or you can do it in this, highly complicated manner. And it still is there. So we, with Mike Gray and others, have kind of called this irremediable complexity. And here is a summary of what I have showed you, pretty much. This is the mitochondrion of a trypanosome, okay? Here you have this kinetoplast disk. And I will tell you, it can get even much, much crazier with the DNA. There is more than 100 proteins that take care of its replication and maintenance. Then you have all these protein complexes, and the numbers actually grew in the meantime, that take care of the pre-edited RNAs and move them around, and in the end, you have some RNA that can be translated. It will not come as a surprise that the mitochondrial ribosome of trypanosomes is the most complex ribosome known. 133 proteins. Many subunits that have not been seen anywhere else. All the RNAs have to be imported. So there is a machinery that has to import the RNAs. And in the end, all this machinery, all this factory or whatever it is, spits out 21 proteins. okay? So you need at least 300 proteins to produce 21 proteins in the procyclic stage. Procyclic stage is a stage that has an active mitochondrion. Rob asked whether the mitochondrion can change. There is a single mitochondrion per cell. It can. And in the bloodstream stage, that is in our blood, well, better not because it's 100% deadly, but if it is in your blood, it takes your glucose, it shuts down the mitochondrion, but one protein has to be produced, the subunit of ATPase6. So the machinery, each component of it, is indispensable for the bloodstream stage also. So any of these 300 proteins, if you knock them down, the cell dies. But in the end, only one protein is produced. So we have a really kind of crazy situation, let's face it. But that's how it is. And so that's the first part of my talk. And we can discuss the reasons why this emerged. And I have first questions here. Okay, because you have, so in an active mitochondrion, you have ATP synthase, okay, that uses the potential, puts in the bloodstream stage, the respiratory complexes are shut down, but something has to keep membrane potential running. So the ATP synthase, which runs, we know the structure, there were Nobel Prizes for it, like this, it actually turns, it switches like this. There is a protein that binds to it, and it goes counterclockwise. And it actually builds membrane potential from so the electrons go the other way, okay? It's using ATP to keep membrane potential. Because you still need membrane potential for that down-regulated mitochondrion, because you, for example, have to make iron sulfur clusters there permanently, okay? Which go then back outside of the mitochondrion into the cytosol. So there are many aspects of this non-respiratory complexes containing mitochondrion have still to be active. And for that, you still need one subunit of this ATPase at that point. And that's the one protein.
That's just the only one.
That's just the only one. Yes.
So you probably explained it, but I missed it. So going back to pre-editing, going back to DNA, you said it was unrecognizable. I think. So what would happen to sort of like correct coding, you know, correct ORF that could be transcribe and translate without editing?
So if I got correctly your question, is if there is... Right. We could introduce it simple. You have DNA. I'm in an institute where I should draw actually on the blackboard, I realized. So you have DNA. That is the pre-edited mRNA. From which an edited mRNA is made. But if you can, you can easily imagine that from the edited mRNA via reverse transcriptase, you will go back to DNA, and then you don't need editing. You can get rid of it perfectly fine. And I told you that there is a pattern when you compare the extent of editing throughout the kinetoplastid, the more we study, the more we know, we can see a pattern. And the activity of reverse transcriptase have been found in the mitochondria. So it's there. And you see that in some cases, this must have happened. But there is still some editing lingering. And if it will be in the one last gene, then the whole machinery is indispensable. We even have, for example, a freely, so there were ideas that this is somehow attached to the parasitic lifestyle, that it brings some level of control, but then we found it in a free-living one. We have a transcript in which only two uridines are added. Just one guide RNA with two uridines. But it makes everything dispensable on those machineries that will insert those two uridines. So here is the second story I wanted to... No, there is no intermediate stage. I thought I will not, I did not include those slides, but I spoke about diplonemids in my previous talk. Okay, and I said also that diplonemids are, so far have been considered very uninteresting organisms, but I think now they will be taken seriously, because they are everywhere. What diplonemids do, so diplonemids are sister group to kinetoplastids, so you would believe, okay, we will see something meaningfully similar. Not at all. Diplonemids split, they also have circles in their DNA. They also have thousands of circles, but they split the protein coding genes into small fragments, and on each circle, one fragment is sitting. So there is a massive transplicing machinery that actually brings splices together these fragments, but no editing. So you have a sister group that developed a totally bizarre, totally unique and different machinery. And then you have third group, euglenids, which are very much also ecologically significant. And until now, nobody was able to sequence their mitochondrial DNA, although their plastid DNA is known for 20 years. And I'm just putting together a paper in which we show that euglenids have perfectly normal mitochondrial DNA. So you have more diversity in mitochondrial RNA processing within this small group of eukaryotes than within the rest of eukaryotes. Right.
Is there any parallel between these two processes or this mitochondrial processing in the
Of course, we will. This is now actually, we are at the stage one. So we know that the diplonemids have it so different, but whether they maybe use a similar machinery, because we are talking of hundreds of proteins that are imported into the mitochondria. They seem not to use guide RNAs. That is one first thing we know. So the machinery, my guess is it will be totally different. Not really. These are protists, so you will have a size of, well, Mike will probably get the numbers better than I do, how many cells are around. Many. It will be not bacterial.
That doesn't mean the effective population.
Yeah, okay, well, the effective population, I don't know. I would say more like prokaryotes. Yeah, definitely.
There have been some calculations done on effective population size, especially for people interested in assessing the evolution of the variant surface antigens in Africa and trypanosomes. I don't recall what, but if you're interested in looking that up, there was one paper I know from somebody with Lex van der Ploeg.
A long time ago. Yeah, there was something, but no, not anything recent.
So it's interesting that plants organelles have, in many cases, editing, but it's a completely different.
It's a completely different editing. So yeah, there is no common denominator to the editings that you find in organelles, in plastids or in mitochondria. No, this editing simply evolved separately it's so far the most complex one. The organelle ones use so-called pentatrichopeptide proteins. So there are hundreds of proteins, again, hundreds of proteins, that actually deal with individual sites. So they don't use guide RNAs. They just use massive diversity of proteins that bind to specific site and edit them. I mean, an editing factor will come and edit it once the protein for position A7 has been bound there, okay? Trypanosomes have also pentatrichopeptide proteins, but use them for slightly different purposes. So,
yeah. So, in a way, they're taking the sequence that is edited and putting it back in the organism, like allows it to work normally?
That is some kind of dream like experiments. That all attempts to genetically manipulate within the mitochondrion so far failed. After a good 15 years of trying, there is total failure so far. So you can manipulate whatever is imported into the mitochondrion, but not this, what is within.
So a brilliant sort of Richard Dawkins gene would be one that creates an editing site. It edits, which would maintain the system.
Yes.
Yes.
Actually,
is
just
there any evidence that something like that happened?
So the second, I will show you another extreme case. Okay, what the kinetoplastids can do, and this my idea for a PhD project, which we will start, is now that you have these kinetoplastids that are marvelously monophyletic. There is no debate that they are really ever since. But they have so different lifestyles. Some of them have one host. The other ones have two hosts. Some others are free living. Some others have a bacterium inside of them, as I may show if we have time spare. And other ones live in another eukaryotic cell. So here you have a fish with white spots. So actually it's damaging aquacultures. And those white spots are caused by an amoeba that is sitting on the gills. And that amoeba is studied and so on, trying to also get rid of it. But when you look carefully into the amoeba, you find something inside there. Something different than a nucleus and a mitochondrion and so on. And that creature that sits there, so this is a section through an amoeba, and that creature that sits there is a kinetoplastid. So like a kinetoplastid can invade human, they can invade a brother protist. And this protist called Perkinsella. It's in all amoeba, it divides with it. But why I'm showing this is that out of this protist, this is the whole protist, this is mitochondrion. So the mitochondrion is inflated, it takes most, this is nucleus of the protist. And the mitochondrial DNA is giant and occupies most space of the cell, while the nucleus is pushed aside and is just a minor spot when you stain it with DAPI. When we sequence the mitochondrial DNA, and it's actually being resubmitted today, we found normal genes there. So normal subset and editing, normal. Protein in the nuclear genome, normal machinery for editing. Everything looks normal. There is just one bizarre thing. The mitochondrial genome, and this is shown here, this is unpublished. The mitochondrial genome, here is Perkinsella, represents 93% of DNA, total DNA of Perkinsella. So Perkinsella is here. I will not go into details, but this was done carefully by a guy in Oxford. The quantifications are, I think, will withstand scrutiny. So, 5 genes in the mitochondrial genome are produced by, so here is the, let's say the numbers. Perkinsella has nuclear genome, nuclear DNA, which represents 5% of total cellular DNA, 5%, and encodes 5,000 genes. We know that. The mitochondrial DNA makes 95% of total cellular DNA and encodes 5 genes. And total amount of that mitochondrial DNA, by our estimation, is 0.5 mega. So it's by far biggest organelle genome known. Why would the cell do that? Help me with that. The copy numbers, we did some Southerns, and the copy number is not overwhelming. So there will be hundreds, like in the normal tripanosome mitochondrion. As you can see here, we actually did this on a number of poorly studied or not studied at all kinetoplastids. So trypanosome, that network I showed you, represents 5% of total cellular DNA. That makes pretty much sense and fits with all the data that has been published so far. But when we take diplonema already has more than 0.5 cellular DNA in the mitochondrion. Trypanoplasma, another bodonid parasitic from fish blood, 0.5. Cryptobia, which you have in garden snails. If you catch a garden snail here, it will have cryptobia. Nice for students, actually. And Perkinsella is just an extreme case of this.
Is the association between Perkinsella and DME permanent?
Yes. It's absolutely permanent. So it's a, yeah. So in your hobby of eukaryotic cell within eukaryotic cell, this is the first case when there is no plastid, no photosynthesis involved. So this is so far the only case, and we are now studying it, and we are about to publish the nuclear genome.
The reason what's really surprising, I know that everybody's looking at 95% DNA, I'm looking at 5,000 genes in the prevalence association, because the one thing that happens when you're inside a carrier is that the nucleus goes. If you retain 5,000 genes, this is a very large genome with a lot of independent. Is there any
very little. We hope to see, so this is done with John Archibald, who is kind of also crazy about cells within cells. And we found 2 or 3 cases only. So there is very little of it. There is a nuclear DNA of a Trypanosoma brucei will encode 10,000 genes. So you already have a loss, 50% loss in the nucleus. And that loss can be actually well explained. So these are, for example, it lost flagellum a long time ago, so our flagella proteins are gone. It lost basal bodies and things like that. But the vesicular machinery is there, and we actually are now trying to figure out the relationship between the amoeba and the flagellate, non-flagellated flagellate, actually. But this is what I wanted to kind of think about with your minds. Why, if you could help me, this is for co-authorship. If somebody figures good reasons for why a cell would produce and replicate, even with low costs, so much DNA for no reason. David? That's right. Yes.
Your assumption here is that these 5,000 genes retained in the kinetoplast are ancestral.
5,000 genes in the nuclear genome. Yes. Well, you have the phylogeny actually is very stable. We can build it now based on. We have a bunch of genes. Interesting is that these are all early branches, so kind of basal branches on the kinetoplastid tree. So the more you go in to the crown group, which is most successful, there are tens of thousands of species, they have small and well organized kinetoplast. As I told you, the catenation might have been the key discovery of the cell, because then it can really control what is being replicated. But if you have a population of circular molecules that are not catenated, supercoiled throughout the lumen, spread throughout the lumen, you can hardly control their their division. So you keep many, many copies. So that's one of the possible explanations of this. But it does not apply to Parkinsella, because the molecules are linear there.
And what is the makeup of that DNA? I mean, isn't the, I don't know, the easiest explanation to the why question the same as your explanation for this bizarre guide RNA process? And your argument of remedial complexity is that you can't ask why it happened, and once it's there, you can't lose it.
Yes.
Is there a similar argument here?
Not really, because I don't know what would put the cell on the path of generating more and more and more mitochondrial DNA.
Well,
as
I say, I don't
even if it.
What answers that question is that we understand why in the kinetoplast, why you can't lose it. I mean, crazy as it seems, no one would ever design a system this way. Once you're there,
there is no way back. Yeah.
So if you understood something more of the mechanism of what all this DNA is doing, is there a similar argument?
Yes, but I have no clue. It's one of possible explanations. No, and this idea was proposed long time ago, and there is no evidence for it. It's a possibility. No. The total amount. So you have a trypanosoma which has 10,000 genes in the nucleus. We'll have and David knows this these numbers exactly, but it will be somewhere between 20 and 30 mega base pairs. For the Parkinsella, we can count that already the mitochondrial genome is half giga. So the mitochondrial genome, the amount of DNA is about half giga base pairs. So you see it's much more, way much more than the total amount. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. In the trypanosome, it will be somewhere 20, 30 mega base pairs, but in the mitochondrion, it's 5% of that. So that will be one mega or something like that. 1 mega base pair in the kinetoplast.
It occurs to me that one reason to have a lot of excess DNA is it's very effective at absorbing damage. So absorbing UV or radiation, any type of radiation, anything, and maybe even oxidative damage. Wonder.
So you would like it would hide inside, for example, the proper versions and cover it with junk DNA to hide it. That's a good idea.
I mean, it might be, and maybe they've just lost protective enzymes.
Yeah.
You know, if
Okay, that's I'm marking this down. Yeah, that's a good one. No. No, what you have, the closest you get is that trypanosomes mate, okay? So if not in culture, not in the medium, you can mix them and they will never, there will be never sexual exchange among them. But if you co-infect a tsetse fly with two different strains, there will be mating and you will get hybrids coming out of it. But this is known to some extent on the nuclear genome, not on the mitochondrial genome. Nobody really examined these hybrids. There was a notion, but those papers are kind of considered false. Mike?
Well, this might be a total coincidence, but you know, there's another famous fish disease called white spot disease, and it's caused by a ciliate.
Ichthyophthirius multifilius.
Yeah, and it turns out that cilia is full of, it has an androsymbiont. It's about 95% of the DNA in the ciliate cell. And you know, ciliates have amplified DNA to start with. And it could be that the bacterium, this is a bacterium that's androsymbiont, and it could be that, you know, the bacterium is really central to the parasitism, you know, more than the ciliate itself. And maybe there's something going on with your bug, too.
I see.
It could be more than just, you know, a passive player in the amoeba, but it could have something to do with parasitism.
Because there are few ciliates that are parasitic, yeah? So you think maybe acquisition of this bacterium made it parasitic, or, but it's full of...
Yeah, it's unclear.
So 90-something percent of all DNA within the...
When they went to isolate the DNA, they kept finding all this incredibly ET-rich DNA, and it was all the bacterium. They couldn't get it out of there because they killed the, with the antibiotics, and they killed the cilia.
Yeah. That's one of the possibilities, that it fills space for some reason. It's just a stuffer. Yeah, it's one of the possibilities we are entertaining. Yeah. So there is third sub-talk, and and this is so what we are doing, just to ease a little bit. This is not for too much of thinking, but what we are doing is that we are exploring the diversity of these organisms. And as you know, there are millions of species of insects, and apparently most insects, or not most, many insects are infected with trypanosomatids. So actually trypanosomatids are everywhere. If we catch fish in the ocean, it will be infected. If we catch a bird flying over here, 10-15% of them will be infected. If you catch a bug, hemipterid, fly, for example, those flies that buzz on the kelp in the swarms, I know they are infected. We looked in some other places. So about 10% of all insects are infected. So that's a powerful force, if you imagine. And pretty much nothing is known what these are doing to them. It's still difficult to get funding for it. Because who cares whether a fly is sick or not. But it matters in Drosophila. And so we are now showing, it's a paper that will appear in MBio, that many conclusions that have been done on Drosophila did not take into consideration that some Drosophila colonies are infected and some are not. And so that started to matter to the Drosophila community, at least to check whether they have their colony infected or not. And there are differences, especially in the immune system. But why I'm showing this to you today is that if you so what we do is we go into the field, Ecuador, Papua New Guinea, Madagascar, the more crazy place, the better. And we catch insects, we dissect them by the in the evening, and then try to get them into culture. So we have with us all the kind of sterile equipment, and we just play with them. And we found an interesting one, which is here shown. and I will show you why it is interesting. It's called A262 at this point. The phylogenetic position by itself is already interesting because it's a sister, the closest sister to Leishmania, which is that important parasite that causes leishmaniasis. But this one is only transmitted from insect to insect, okay? Not insect and humans. We were lucky not to get this one. And when we looked at it carefully, we found that there is, first of all, that they have amastigotes, which is a stage specific for leishmania. So that was already interesting. But we found that it contains a bacterium, an endosymbiont. And that's shown here. Mike just said that Ichthyophthirius contains bacteria, no big deal. But we think this is a big deal, and I will tell you why. So here you have nucleus. This is kinetoplast. It always stains very intensely. And here are the bacteria. So there are more bacteria. In this case, six. When we look into the culture, we think that bacteria may be in many more, but when we isolate them from the trypanosomatids in the field, we have to add antibiotics there. So we kill off those that carry bacteria selectively. And so here we see that in one cell you can have many, and in another cell you have one. Here is how the bacterium looks like. It's in a parasitophorous vacuole. Sometimes it seems to be lysed. So it's a dynamic relationship. And so far, for 30 years, there is one clade of trypanosomatids that carries bacteria isolated in Brazil. And those bacteria belong to this group of bacteria called Kinetoplastibacterium. They are studied really for 30 years. And it's known that this bacterium always divides in good correlation with the nuclear division. So there is always a single one per cell. But the one that we found, and it's only a second case now, is here. So another Burgdorferia. And that apparently does not control how many cells are per cell. So how many bacteria are. So the relationship is more dynamic. The cell tries to lyse them, but they are there. They stick to it. And here is a tree of those the known trypanosomatids containing a bacterium. Actually, you have a big clade. You can, as long as you find them all over the world, it's apparently one event. They are always derived. So all the bacteria containing trypanosomatids are monophyletic, with the exception of the one that we have found. So we have two events. Why do I think it's so potentially interesting? Because here we have the same host, trypanosomatid, two related bacteria, but different. In one case, we believe the relationship is established and long-lasting. In the other case, it happened much more recently. So what we are now about to do is to look whether there is exchange of proteins among these. There are data by a group in Germany who studies that well-known relationship of that bacterium inside of a trypanosomatid, and they already have several proteins that are being, the genes have been transmitted from the bacterium into the nucleus, and the protein is re-imported into the bacterium. So you have an organelle in preparation. You have the first elemental things that the gene is transferred out of it, and the product is imported back into it. So now we want to look into this system that is so close, where the same proteins have been picked or different. And that can, I think, tell quite a bit about endosymbiosis and how an organelle comes to into existence. How many genes? You mean how many genes? Actually, I'm not at the liberty to say these things because they are not my data. Few. But there is nice evidence. They have been tagged. So you can follow them back. Still normal genome. Yeah. If there are changes, very, very subtle, almost invisible, I would say. Right. So we haven't done that with this bacterium, but it was shown by this 30-year studied trypanosomatid bacterium relationship that the bacterium provides heme to the cell. So trypanosomatids lost the heme synthetic pathway, but the bacterium has it. And you can even kill off the bacterium.
Can you grow bacteria? Can you grow bacteria in culture?
No.
I'm thinking about the no.
So far, no. That all these attempts failed. And they were tried repeatedly in Brazil, so you cannot grow it outside anymore. Now, there is a pretty strong association between the two.
And the same goes for the new one that you find later.
And we believe so, yes. We haven't tried it, though, yet. But you can kill off the bacterium with an antibiotic, and as long as you provide heme into the medium, the cells will survive. So the only gift by the bacterium, and it's a big bacterium. I mean, it's like you would carry in your body this big sack, which just gives you only heme. But they go with it. So this is first fourth element of the lecture, and I still have a few minutes. So again, an interesting insight you can get if you collect these trypanosomatids. We call this one Paratrypanosoma confusa, and we found it in Prague. We hope that, of course, when we go to Papua New Guinea, we believe that we will find some really interesting one. But the most interesting one has been found in Prague, so I'm not showing that to the grant agencies kind of justify our trips. And why is it so interesting? This is a busy slide, sorry for that. It's interesting just for this audience by its phylogenetic position. So it branches on the base of the trypanosomatids. What you have, I'm talking about trypanosomatids, and this is an umbrella name for trypanosomes, leishmanias, phytomonas, parasites of plants, serious ones, and all of these are nicely monophyletic. They emerge from the free living lifestyle of Bodo saltans, that is also pretty strongly shown, and are all tens of thousands of species are parasitic. Either they have single host or two hosts, but they are parasitic. And the question always was for 100 years debated by parasitologists, what was first? Was it first the vertebrate host or the invertebrate that transmits it? Was it tsetse fly that was infected and transmitted it by biting the vertebrate, or was it the other way around? And we think we have a solution to it, because in this case, and this is, I mean, very well supported position, so there is no doubt, in science you never know, but for beyond reasonable doubt, that this is a basal branch to the Dixenus trypanosomes, and it's monoxenius. So we show that it was insects, always insects. In case of Leishmania, that is clear. Leishmania branches in the middle of insect-only flagellates. So all these bugs were transmitted to us from insects that were taking blood, that were feeding on a vertebrate, and transmitted their parasites, and they invaded the niche and established themselves in that niche. And there is a beautiful evidence. They found an amber, trapped insect in an amber, and it seems to be a mosquito, which contains something like Leishmania inside. It's 120 million years old. It also contains, they were able to cut through it and find the kDNA, the kinetoplast, the disc, is there. So 120 million years ago, that kinetoplast disc I was talking in the beginning was perfectly ready. And around this flagellate is red blood cells without nuclei. So it's probably dinosaur blood. So you have even fossil evidence for these things existing for quite some time. That's how it is with protists. And as if you start looking for something, then you find it. So actually, when we realize what is paratrypanosoma and how interesting it is, and we are studying it, we believe it can give us an insight into how the monoxenous life or the monoxenous lifestyle is transformed into the dixenous lifestyle by studying the genes that are there. So we found it now everywhere. It's in the US, all over the place. People actually sequenced it, but did not know that it's so interesting because they had only small pieces of DNA and they were not really particularly interesting. This is another rendition of it. So you have the free living bodonids. And you always to Phytomonas, always to the Dixonous one, to the one bastards that either parasitize vertebrates or plants, you always have a sister group that parasitizes insects only. So we believe we put the end to the discussion. Paratrypanosoma has marvelous features. Last slides, I guess. They look so different from the rest. They can attach themselves. They stick. So this is a glue that is quite amazing. It would be really nice to find out what it is made from, and so on and so forth. And this is the diversity studies. You can look into fleas, for example. So if you want a nice project for a student, insect trypanosomatids are all over the place. And nobody studies them in the US. They have viruses, plenty of viruses, which matters because there was a science paper a few years ago showing that Leishmania with virus is more pathogenic and causes bigger sores than Leishmania without them. So all things considered. This is one last slide that I'm showing. So we are trying to map the diversity of this group. And we think we are getting to the saturation. So it was predicted that every insect had its own trypanosomatids. So there would be millions of species of trypanosomatids. That's not the case. They are transmitted from one species to another. And actually, when we have now somewhere around 12 clades, and when we sequenced about 100 new strains from Papua New Guinea, no new clade appeared. So you just expand those clades, but there is no, the diversity is not enormous. And so most of this work was done in our lab. So these are the guys who participated in various projects. And the grant support comes from these agencies and Canadian Institute for Advanced Research. And it's all happening in České Budějovice. But I always use the Budweis for Budweiser name. I always propose that the university is called University of Budweiser, but they did not pass. And the picture has been taken. So still from the tallest building in town that been built in 1555. So not much is happening there, but we are still trying to push the ball. Thanks for your attention. I will answer to that question as follows. So if you want to work with Perkinsella, you have to grow agar plates. You have to put bacteria on those agar plates. Then you seed amoeba on those bacteria. You have to have it just right so that the bacteria does not overgrow the amoeba that are eating them. You keep expanding this on petri dishes, And in the end, you collect amoebas, and out of those amoebas, you collect some DNA for Perkinsella. And so for one lane of a sudden, you need, well, no, for three lanes, you need like 3 months of growing. So it's a terrible one to work with. So we can hardly address these issues at this point, unless we really can produce them in good amount. That does not apply for anything else I was talking about. All the trypanosomatids, paratrypanosomatids, the one bacteria carrying the diplonemids from the ocean, we can grow them to density 10 to 7, 10 to 8, sometimes, well, yeah. So we can have a lot, but not of Perkinsella. So we really don't know. We are happy to just sequence whatever is there, and that's about it. Don't know more about it. David.
I just wanted to make a comment that follows up on some conversations that I've had with people over the last couple of days, that I think follows on from Jay's talk yesterday and yours today, that will continue on Tuesday next week, I guess, which is a shameless plug for protozoan diversity. So, I mean, Julius has done a great job of articulating the weird and wonderful things these bugs do, as you can tell from his enthusiasm. It's a great field to work in if you
get funding.
If you travel to Papua New Guinea or wherever is appealing. For some people, it is. Other people who enjoy sitting in the office and modeling things, maybe the idea of spending a month in Papua New Guinea sounds like more of a nightmare than a deal. But for those who are interested in these kinds of modeling questions, essentially all of the organisms that Julius has talked about, the organisms that they talked about, and that Anna Flagellates, the organisms I'll talk about on Tuesday in the AP Complexa, genomes are sequenced for them. There are several thousand completely sequenced genomes for eukaryotic microbes, probably now approaching more than the number of sequenced genomes, or maybe must be more than the number of sequenced genomes for metazoa and plants combined, and those numbers will only grow. And those include fairly dense sampling of a lot of things of interest, including these basal groups in the Paratrypanosoma and Bodo, or Perkinsus is basal to the dinoflagellate, so I'll probably say something about Promira and Petrella on Tuesday, which means that we have a pretty rich resource for looking at them. And there are also now, for people interested in protein structure, through structural genomics efforts, pretty extensive structural information. So for the endosome complex, I think most, maybe even all of those proteins have been crystallized, including many complexes.
Yes.
Many. And that provides a pretty rich resource for looking not just at the weird and wonderful diversity that can give us insight into funky things like editing or.
Most diversity on this planet, eukaryotic diversity, is hidden in protists. So if you really, I can't agree more. A lot has been sequenced. It's biased to the parasitic species still in the protist domain, but that bias is now kind of recognized. So some free living are being also sequenced. So there is a lot of data and not so many people who are asking questions.
But there are
how
also
to use
a lot
it.
Of interesting biological questions here. So for those who are interested in, say, population genetic analysis, one of the things that most like to know, I would really like to know issues about calculations of effective population size. We would like to be able to estimate those retroactively. I mean, you'd like to know what the effective population size was of the ancestor that gave rise to the divergence of whatever this was, Paratrypanosoma and parasitic protists.
We have population questions like bottlenecks, major bottlenecks. So the billions of trypanosomes in your blood go through a bottleneck of a tsetse fly that picks them up, just a few, 10, 20, 50. So there are questions in population,
really
from the population size perspective that are not addressed. Nobody actually studies them. And as David said, the last papers were by Lex van der Ploeg, and that's 25 years ago or 20. So yeah, we would just let's use it as the final word. Consider working on protists. We will not treat you as competition, but we would invite you and embrace you and so on. Okay, thank you.